good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of a Pen and a Napkin Podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to our interview series, episode number 243, and thrilled to have John Miller. If you're from Nebraska, you know John, legendary coach at Chambers with the girls, at Southern Valley with the boys, now retired and kind of living the high life here, just gets to relax, play with the grandkids all weekend, all of that good stuff there. So excited to have John on here this weekend, and we're really excited to mention our founding sponsor, Cosac Chiropractic, which is located here in Omaha, just off of 144th and Maple. Coaches, if you or in your athletes are struggling with balance, neck, or spinal issues, have them go see Cosac Chiropractic. You can check out their practice at cosacchiro.com or give them a call, 402-964-0300. Follow us on Twitter at a pen and a napkin. We try to put out daily coaching tidbits on the Twitter handle. I will say this. Something happened with my Twitter handle. It's very frustrating. Elon is not cooperating with me. I've called him. I don't know what's going on, but we're going to get that sorted out here hopefully sooner rather than later. So just please be patient with me there. If you're listening, download, rate, review, give us 5 stars, talk about a pen and a napkin, say good things about us. It helps us move up in the rankings. Questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me at penandanapkin@gmail.com. John Miller, how are you doing this fine, kind of warmish Sunday evening here in Nebraska?
God, it's a great day. Yep. Beautiful day today.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So everything's kind of drying out. I have to mow at least one more time for sure. Probably two, but it's getting closer to my favorite month anyway. October, it's my favorite month of the year. Love it, love it, love it. So I'm excited. John, I hope you're excited to come on here tonight.
It's always fun to talk basketball. So
yeah. All right. Well, let's jump into it, John. For folks that don't know about you, don't know about your basketball journey, tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us about your career in basketball here and coaching in general.
Well, I graduated from Kearney State College and in it with a teaching degree, and I really didn't plan on going into high school. I kind of wanted to stick around Kearney and be a GA and help, because I kind of helped at the time with just hanging around the gym a lot. Another coach up in the Chambers area that I had played some softball and baseball with told me about an opening at Chambers and said it was a good school, good people. I should try and check it out. So I went and interviewed, got the job, and that's kind of how it started. I really wasn't interested in coaching girls. Girls that just maybe was in their fourth or fifth year of actual basketball.
Yep.
But that's what was open at the time. So I did it and I just fell in love with it. They worked so hard and it was a great experience, and kind of ended up staying with it for 30 years. So,
Yeah. And then you decided to go down to Southern Valley. What was kind of the impetus with that, Coach?
Well, that was kind of a strange thing. We were sitting around one night and the superintendent at Southern Valley at the time was actually from our area and our conference at Chambers. He was originally at Orchard and then at Atkinson West Holt. He called and said he had a job opening at boys basketball opening at Southern Valley. And we kind of laughed about it the first couple times. And and the more we kind of talked about it, we kind of said, you know, we're always challenging kids to get out of their comfort zone, to do something. And to tell you the truth, there was a part of me that wondered if I could really coach or not, I guess. You know, we had a program at Chambers and just kind of kept plugging kids in. Could I go somewhere else and be successful, or is just a one school deal? And next thing you know, we kind of had a little family vote and off to Southern Valley we went. So
load up the Mayflower moving truck and headed a couple hours south there then, huh?
We definitely, I remember we on the way down, we stopped in Ord, they had McDonald's there, and and I looked over at my wife and she was as white as a sheet. I'm like, God, are you okay? And she goes, what are we doing? It kind of set in that we actually were on the way, but what a great experience it was. We had a lot of fun. So
Well, yeah, it had to be a huge change after being at the same school for 30 years. And, you know, what was I went through it. I mean, I was 19 years and then changed schools. So not quite 30, you know, but a good chunk of change. I know kind of some of the things that I went through. How about you, John?
Well, you know, the best part of it was we kind of had to reinvent ourselves. Mm-hmm. I had done boys 1 year at Chambers. We co-op with Wheeler Central our last year there, and I switched over to boys. And so I had kind of, you know, some 1 year, but I'd always coached football too. So it wasn't like, you know, I hadn't been around them, but, you know, you had to kind of reinvent yourself and resell yourself. And it was really good for me. It made me really dig back into the game and learn the game. And so I think it was a great career move.
Mm-hmm. How about the classroom part of it? Was there a big adjustment there?
You know, not too much. After the first, I was athletic director, principal, taught health, weights, PE stuff at Chambers. And eventually that's my class load down at Southern Valley ended up the same thing when we, the last few years, I was the principal and athletic director there and was kind of involved with a few of the PE classes. So, you know, there wasn't a great change there other than just, you know, a lot more kids. We went from basically a D2 to a big C2 school. Yeah. Just classroom adjustments, learning that the kids. Southern Valley was kind of unique in the sense that they, you know, they had three or four towns that were all, you know, co-op consolidated then. So, you know, you kind of had to learn where at Chambers we knew everybody. So, you know, that took a while.
Mm-hmm. One of you, you know, obviously it helps to have great players. We know as coaches, our one loss record is most affected by having great players. And if you have great players, you're probably going to have a great one loss record. But you can make a claim, John, that you coached one of the best, if not maybe the best individual high school player that the state has ever produced in Darcy Strackey. You know, for folks that don't know about Darcy, if you're listening to this from somewhere not in Nebraska, over 2,700 points, the four straight state championships, three of them with you at Chambers there. She averaged over 30 points a game in her state tournament career. But sometimes it can be a challenge to coach a great player for a variety of different reasons. And in some ways, that you know, people may not think of it in that regard. What are some things that you learned coaching Darcy?
Well, this may sound odd, but I almost feel guilty with her because there really was no learning curve. That girl was 100% team. She was a workaholic, the hardest worker, earliest one in. You know, a lot of times we talk about kids who have talent sometimes aren't real motivated, and the ones that are motivated don't have the talent. She was one of those rare players that actually had both, and our kids saw that, and, you know, there was it just worked out really, really good. And the maturity of our other girls on our team was very commendable also, because, you know, to have somebody come in like that, you know, we were really good before she came in. In fact, when she was a freshman at Stewart and won a couple of those, she won a state championship at Stewart as well, her freshman year, they had two of their three losses that year were to us. So, it, yeah. You know, it wasn't like she all of a sudden just rejuvenated a program.
Sure.
So for all of a sudden her to come in and join, we had all those girls back too as well.
Yep.
Just the blending of them, but they accepted her. They saw her work ethic. They, you know, I feel, like I say, I feel kind of guilty because I really never had to deal with anything. The maturity of our crew was so good that it just worked out perfectly.
Yeah. You know, one of the fine lines, the art of coaching, John, sometimes is when you do have that great player, how much of it is, you know, just letting them take charge, letting them go, letting them do what they are blessed to be able to do. But also, you know, you also want to have the team concept, especially in a sport like ours. You know, how did you kind of, during that time period, coaching somebody like Darcy, you know, ride that line of keeping everybody involved, but then letting Darcy do what she was great at?
Well, I think I think probably the girls we had prior to that knew how invested I was in them and that I cared about them. And that never changed at all when Darcy got there. And I remember having my comp. And the thing is, too, though, is Darcy played tournaments with us through sixth, seventh, eighth grade with that same group of girls all the time. And so there was a chemistry there already.
Gotcha.
And when I first, you know, told the rest of our girls that she was actually going to come to Chambers, you know, I said, I expect you to treat her like you would treat anyone that came to our school from outside. You know, we're going to treat with empathy and respect. And, you know, which I really didn't need that conversation with them because it wasn't going to be a problem. There was already some excitement with that. But I think just the girls already knew who I was and how I was going to coach. And our practices were intense, and everybody got reps, and everybody got, you know, time spent with them. So it wasn't like, you know, everybody went and stood in the corner while Darcy did everything.
Sure.
We had another 1,000-point scorer on that team, the same grade of Darcy. And we had another one that was 970-some, almost three. And we actually had another one that was around 800 that tore ACL our senior year that, you know, we possibly could have 4,000-point scorers on that team.
Yeah, you look pretty smart during that stretch, John.
My hardest thing during that whole stretch was just picking out a tie and a shirt.
but there had to be some stuff to it there. Obviously you're steering the ship. You're in charge of the rudder. You're in charge of setting the tone, and keeping, you know, you could have a lot of these kids that could whine, complain, this, that, the other thing. Obviously there were a bunch of other talented kids alongside of Darcy, you know, so how did you kind of keep everything steady during that time period? Not too up, and obviously you had very few downs. You know, for those of you that, for folks that don't know, during this time period, it was 87 games in a row that you won, Coach, right?
Yes.
Yeah, 87. So obviously very few downs during this time period, but you don't want to look past anybody. You know, how are you coaching the mental side of the game with a lot of those kids during that time?
Well, I think a lot of it is, and even, you know, visiting with some of our girls in the past, as they'll bring up, we never once ever mentioned winning.
Uh-huh.
We never mentioned the win streak. We never mentioned winning. We came to work every day, worked hard on fundamentals, worked hard on a game plan. I don't care if a team we played was zero and whatever or was a rated team. We basically approached it the exact same way, made sure all our bases were covered. We knew what inbounds, our scouting was pretty thorough. We knew, you know, what we wanted to take care of it. We never mentioned really a lot of times even who we were playing. We just talked about, you know, what we had to stop and things like that. And I think that kind of helped keep us pretty grounded as far as never getting too, you know, too cocky, I guess, or too out of alignment. And then I think our style of play really helped us too, because at that particular time, I mean, we pressed full court. We were run and gun. And so, you know, when you play that way, we could play a lot of girls. Yep. And we could, we had a lot of people that got to touch the ball, got to, you know, be a part of our defense. That, you know, nothing was, we weren't half court oriented with everybody else get out of the way and it's balls in her hand type of thing. It was, and I was lucky because most of the other girls were very talented and did really good things as well. So yeah, it was just a fun experience.
But I think that is so important. To treat every opponent the same, you know, and I love what you said about their coach, you know, just because, you know, we've done this and this team is not very good, we're still going to treat it the same way. And, you know, just how important, you know, for the coaches listening, how important is that for coaches to have that steady Eddie, attitude with your team?
Well, I know it's a long time ago, but I can even remember as a player, you know, I wanted to know the specifics. I didn't care about the other stuff. I wanted to know a little bit about what we needed to do to be successful. And I think just kind of maintaining an even keel, not being too high, too low. We always told our girls, you know, walk off the court like you expected to win. We're not going to show anybody up. We're, you know, we're not going to celebrate on a play. We don't need to. We expect to make that play. Let's act like it, you know. And we preach that stuff constantly. We meet before practice and we set a tone. We always had a goal we went over and talked about. We always met afterwards. You know, I think all those things in over a course of time just start to kind of add up with your team, and you know, you kind of see the results of it.
Mm-hmm. In 1993, Counting Crows referred to Omaha as somewhere in Middle America. More people know Omaha as the home of Warren Buffett, the Union Pacific Railroad, and the College World Series. Athletically, Nebraska is known for its dominance in college and high school football and volleyball, while basketball has perennially been on the back burner. But for one season, in its largest city, basketball was king of the state. In a time of social and political turmoil in our country, three high school boys basketball teams from Omaha, Nebraska were ranked in the top 25 in the country, featuring some of the best talent that one city has ever produced anywhere in the country. Amongst these three teams were nine Division I basketball players, and all 15 starters from these three teams played collegiate athletics at various levels for at least two seasons. Kings of their court, three teams, one city, and the greatest basketball season in Nebraska high school history begins with the chaotic ending of the 2020 state tournament as the whole world was shutting down due to the COVID-19 virus. Over the span of the next year, these players, coaches, and parents navigated their basketball futures while also, like the rest of the United States and the world, worked through COVID quarantines, the George Floyd murders and riots, the political turmoil of the 2020 presidential campaign, and much more. One year later, the destinies of these three teams would intertwine themselves for the final time at the 2021 Nebraska State Basketball Tournament, where the crescendo to this story occurred 365 days after it began, with some of the best high school basketball any state has ever seen. Kings of their court, three teams, one city, and the greatest basketball season in Nebraska high school history is the story of highly driven individuals searching to achieve lifelong dreams and aspirations, both on and off the basketball floor, during a season that almost didn't happen. Kings of Their Court will be published on October the 1st, Tuesday, October the 1st. Kindle copies are $9.99. Paperback copies are $19.99. Copies are eligible to be pre-ordered today, so be sure to get on Amazon.com and pre-order your copy of Kings of Their Court.
You know, John, you guys, it wasn't like you were a flock of seagulls or Dexy's Midnight Runners. This was not the only successful stretch that you had at Chambers. I mean, going back to your list here, you know, multiple other state runner-up and state championship teams. But you're in a tremendously small community. I mean, according to Wikipedia, which is the all-knowing, here, 268 people live within the city limits of Chambers. So, not exactly a metropolis, but year in and year out, your kids really consistently did really, really solid things. What was the key for you to build that consistent program to where even if you had kind of a down year genetically, you were still going to compete?
Well, one thing, I was very lucky that Chambers was just a very solid community. Just people, the parents, the morals of the community were solid. The kids worked, and they knew what that was like, and they had great, you know, their home lives were really good. A lot of support there at home. So that really helped. Another thing I really helped is I was also the PE teacher there. So we, you know, hand-eye, foot-eye coordinational things, we really got after them on that. And building that connection, like I talked about, was already there. Our fifth, sixth graders could run a lot of our system already in fifth and sixth grades. Junior high was there. I could usually just plug in a junior high kid in right into high school with our drills and right into our system. So the continuity was really huge. And when I made the statement about going to Southern Valley, I that wouldn't have been there. So I was really curious if the only reason we won was because of that. But those kids, you know, they looked up to these kids. We did a lot of things with our older kids where we got involved with Saturday morning camps. We run our basketball camps. Our players ran that. We tried to really build relationships with our younger kids and mentors and things like that. And then when a group graduated, you know, that group that Darcy played on, we was five seniors. When they graduated, a lot of people in the area said, well, you're not going to be very good now. We went 15-0 to start the next year with, yeah. you know, the next kids that we plugged in. But there was just kind of a standard that people want, you know, our girls wanted to play to. And, you know, it was just, it, you know, I'm not going to lie. There were times I sat on the bench and went, how are we winning this? Uh-huh. How are we beating this team? I mean, these girls, do they not realize that we are completely outmanned and but we're winning this. I'm not going to tell them any different, you know? So that was kind of a fun situation.
But you know, that makes sense, building that continuity and getting people on board in the community. I mean, how important is it to get people to follow your vision? You know, you could talk about your vision, you could try and implement your vision, but until people really follow that vision and help you implement it, it's kind of all for naught.
You know, and like with our feeder programs, when we grew up, you know, I tried to involve our parents. I ran everything, but, you know, nowadays, a lot of times the head coaches, you know, don't have anything to do with the, and I think that's kind of a tough situation for you to be in. I mean, I think you need to be seen. I think you need to be out there. I think you need to coach your feeder coaches, what you want, how you want the kids treated, what they want, how you want them to start thinking, the mental toughness phase of those kind of things. And then the parents kind of see that. I think of the parents, if they see you treating their kid right and with respect, and they know their kid is having fun and enjoys being a part of that, you've probably got their support. It's when, so, you know, that was one thing we really tried to involve, and it just happened to work out, I guess.
Mm-hmm. How, I mean, John, you're a guy that stayed in a small school for a long time, and we're, you know, you were very content there. And you probably have situations that you maybe could have left for, so forth. You know, so it wasn't all about the winning and the losing for you. But you had kind of made reference to it before about, well, could I do this somewhere else? And, you know, I would think it had to be really, really satisfying for you to kind of cap off the end of your career or towards the end of your career with a state championship with the boys team on the other gender line here, at a completely different school. I mean, that had to be, for you, a personal point of pride, I would think.
Well, it's, you know, kind of odd, but when we won that state championship there, it was almost like I just took a deep breath and relaxed because it was completed, you know, mm-hmm. It was like my answers, I got answers to my questions and I felt good about things. And I, you know, so I don't really know how to explain that other than the part that was the best for me is I really went back to work again. Mm-hmm. And I think I might've started getting a little complacent and toward the end of Chambers. Mm-hmm. And I started all over again. I mean, I dug in and, you know, we went 2-a-days in practice and hit fundamentals hard again. And just that was really good for me. It just, you know, they say you need to be a life learner. Well, this forced me to be a life learner again and get busy.
Mm-hmm. What if any challenges did you kind of face taking over a new program in a new school in that regard and trying to, I mean, was everybody pretty well on board? Were the kids on board with everything that you wanted to do? Obviously, they had to be to a large degree because you had success. But just curious about it.
Well, the thing I've heard when I got there, and you know, it probably varies of who you talk to, but and I'm not sure the exact number, but I think they told me when I interviewed they'd had 11 years without a winning record. When I first met the boys, I asked them kind of what their goals would be. And there was a lot of them in there that said they just wanted to win a bunny bracket in either a conference or a sub districts. Because I remember reading them and thinking, oh my. And then when I interviewed, I walked through the halls and there was a whole bunch of them in the gym playing basketball. And I was like, well, that's cool. And so I stood and watched them. I thought, you know, some of these kids look pretty good. So, it was tough at first, a little bit undisciplined. In fact, I kicked some kids out of the game in some summer leagues. I had some coaches at summer league told me I was having a season ending or career ending decision here and wondering what I was doing and things like that. And actually that I'm glad because that motivated me even more. And then I could kind of slowly see it as the season started and went on. We had some rough patches, but we actually started playing some pretty decent basketball. We went 18-7 my first year. And North Platte St. Pat's beat us on a half-court shot to go to the district final, and then they ended up going to state, I think, to the semis. So then most of my pieces were back that next year, and you could just kind of see there was a whole little another level of concentration, intensity, goal setting that next year. And then, you know, then that second year we ended up winning it. So,
I had a really good question and I forget what it was. I lost my train of thought. Dang it. I promise you, John, it was a great question too. It was just like, it was right there. It was terrific. So, I'll, you know what? I won't think about it. And then I'm going to, since I'm the host, I'm going to reserve the ability to come back to it. If I think,
yeah, that no sounds problem. So,
you know, John, you left Southern Valley. You're now at Stewart. You said, seventh year there at Stewart.
Yeah, this fall will be, or this winter will be my seventh year. So.
So, over 700 wins. You're a Hall of Famer. What's the draw? I mean, you've done about everything that you could do. You could be sailing off into the sunset. You could be stopping at McDonald's in Ord whenever you felt like it. What keeps you coming back to the gymnasium?
You know, when we moved to Lincoln in 2016, I didn't coach that year. And my wife told me I was the most irritable, hard to live with person there was. And so when we moved back to Stewart, I took it. I just love the strategy. I love being in the gym. I love seeing the kids. All of it just kind of puts you on a high. You just kind of feel empty when you're not doing it. So I have a grandson that's going to be in third grade, and he's playing a lot of ball now at Kinetic and Speedway and Lincoln. And God, I'm on cloud nine, even just going and watching that kind of competition and basketball and watching those kids. So I don't hunt. I don't fish. I don't have any other hobbies. I play a little bit of golf, not much, but this is my hunting and fishing.
Yeah.
So
how do you think you've changed over the years?
Well, my wife thinks I've gotten a lot softer.
Yeah.
There'll be times we get down at practice, she'll walk off and she'll just be looking at me and I'll go, what? And she'll go, you would have never let that fly, you know. And then I kind of a funny little story. I was sitting there with my coach and all my kids. My daughter was a real good player. Both my sons were good. But I was sitting with my daughter at the grandson's, and he did some things that, you know, really probably weren't real fundamentally solid. And I kind of told him, that's okay. That's okay. Kind of put my arm around her. I looked over my shoulder and she was just staring at me and she goes, who are you?
So. Yeah. You know, I don't think it's necessarily we soften becoming more seasoned and experienced, as we say here on the pod. I think we just realize what we need to get upset about or get a little fired up about and what is not as necessary to get fired up about. Would you agree with that, John?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think you prioritize a lot more what's important.
Yep. Coaches, if you are in the Omaha, Council Bluffs, Lincoln metropolitan areas and surrounding areas, it is that time of year again. It is time for the 2024 MBCA Fall Coaches Clinic Series. We're going to start this on Wednesday, September 18th. We're going to go 4 weeks in a row, September 18th, 25th, October the 2nd, and October the 9th. And we have got a great lineup of coaches. Drew Johnson, women's basketball coach at Nebraska Kearney. Marty Levinson, new men's basketball coach at Nebraska Kearney. Tim Sandquist, head men's basketball coach at Kirkwood Community College. Carrie Amy, the new women's basketball coach at the University of South Dakota. Mark Swoboda, from my alma mater, Briarcliff University, go Chargers, head men's basketball coach there. Coach Sabota is going to be down. Amy Williams, head women's basketball coach at the University of Nebraska, is going to be one of our guests. We've got a couple more slots to fill. So it is going to be a great series of clinics. It's going to be located at Legends Sports Bar here in Omaha, 72nd and Pacific Street, just east of 72nd Street there. And for those four clinics, $80 is going to cover your clinic fees, the beverages, the food, and the camaraderie, the networking, all of those different things you're going to have at the Metro Basketball Coaches Association Coaches Clinics here this fall series. It's going to be a great run of coaches, so I encourage you, get signed up today. If you want to get signed up, if you want more information, you can send an email to Tom Crable at mbcaomaha@gmail.com. And Tom will get back to you. He'll get you all the information that you need. So coaches, get signed up for this fall's run of coaches clinics for the Metro Basketball Coaches Association.
Well, let's transition here, John. We're going to go into the John Wooden quote of the day here today. Coach Miller, are you ready, sir, for the John Wooden quote of the day?
Yes, definitely.
All right. So from Wooden, A Lifetime of Observations, page 160, the Wooden quote of the day is, "Though I was pleased with the titles and championships, I mainly derived satisfaction from the preparation and knowing that I had done everything I could, to get the team ready. That is what always pleased me the most, regardless of what anybody else thought."
Absolutely. Absolutely. I tell our kids all the time, do not waste 1 second of your energy on an outcome. Mm-hmm. Trust your training. Think about what we've done. You know, play as hard as you can. Those are what all of your focus needs to go on. And that process, that training, whether it's in the gym or learning how to defend a pick and roll and then seeing it actually occur in, you know, practice, or knowing exactly what they're going to do on a press break in a late game situation, and you've got it, and your kids can step in front of a pass and steal it because they know that's where they're going with it. That stuff is just still gives me goosebumps, man. I love that stuff. So
yeah,
yes, the preparation, I could care less about the wins. I've said a lot of time that there are so many coaches way better than I am that maybe have taken a team that should win 5 games but have won 11. Mm-hmm. Just because of that.
Yeah.
But don't have those state championships and don't have those lucrative records, but they can coach their hind end off. And unfortunately, those people really don't get the recognition. So I've just been blessed with a lot of just good kids every year. So
mm-hmm. Was that something that you felt like you started out with, John, or was it more of something, again, kind of like with a lot of our skills that we develop as coaches, you developed as you became more seasoned and experienced?
Well, I don't know. I think myself, even growing up playing sports, I was one of the few that probably really loved practice. I just couldn't get enough. Like, summer baseball practices, I would practice with my group, and then I would want to stick around and I'd practice with the next group. you know, all those things that are still in my head or footwork things. And I'm just more interested. I've always been interested in that side of things than just wanting to just go out and win. It's never that important to me as getting yourself ready to be in that position.
Mm-hmm. Let's dive into your philosophy here, Coach. Let's talk about some things here. Obviously, when you're at a smaller school, and especially with the geographic location of yours, you know, you're not going to have a lot of kids moving in and moving out. So player development is important everywhere, but it's really, really important in you know, a situation like yours. So, you know, at this time, John, I'm just going to kind of turn it over to you. You know, tell us a little bit about your player development, your philosophy, some things that you did with your kids. I'm going to sit back. If I need to interrupt, I will politely do so. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just tell us about what you've done over the years.
Well, I think the main thing is, you know, getting them interested at a young age and being walking that fine line and making sure they're having fun. Uh-huh. You know, I read a lot of times, even with shooting, like younger kids, don't worry about their shooting form. Let them get out on a court and shoot baskets, make baskets, have fun. So we tried to keep our developmental program with a lot of like contests, relays, fun things, giveaways, all of those kind of things. We really stress the hand-eye coordinational things, ball handling. You know, we used to do half times. Our first graders would do a ball handling drills at half times of games. You know, we kind of get them started, putting a ball in their hand, doing those kind of things. And then we advance up into, you know, we kind of had a progression of where we wanted each group to be at each year. Did that always come through? No, some groups were a little further ahead, but you know, even things like footwork of shuffling, stance, but we try to make it kind of fun for them. But I would say probably that thing is just building, and being there for them and making sure that it's not work, that it's, they don't dread not coming, and making it fun. God, we would have, afterwards, we'd have pizzas, we'd have Pops, Gatorades, whatever, for the kids. Just sit around and talk to them. Just sit down on the gym floor afterwards and talk to them. Yeah, I think that was probably the thing, and it was fun. That was the thing that was one thing I really admired as you do your coaching tree coming up. But Paul Baronic, who was at Ravenna for a long time and mm-hmm. really developed a lot of great players there. I watched him do some camps, and God, his kids just had a blast at those kids. He always had these catch clap games and stuff. The kids would, you know, just a lot of fun things for him to do. And that, you know, you just kind of pick up little things like that all the way along the way and implement them into your system as you go. Give them t-shirts, give them, you know, those kind of things, and getting them involved, keeping and seeing them in the hallway, stopping and talking to them. Little third grader, asking him how he's doing, giving him a hard time about what kind of shirt he's wearing, if it's a team that, you know, you don't like and they do, you know, just all those kind of things. I think you're just an accumulation of everything. And then what you find is those kids want to play so hard for you. They just, it turns out more they want to please and you know, it's kind of hard to put your finger on it, but I think it's like, you know, you've heard the old cliche, but it's kind of like building a house. You don't throw the roof on first. It takes a long time to dig that hole and get that dirt out of there and lay those blocks. And that's not fun. Cause it's hard work. And what I mean by not fun, I mean, it takes a lot of time. You got to put that time in with them to do that. But boy, does it pay off, you know, in the long run down the road. So
do you think that was easier, because you were in such a small school and all the kids were kind of, you know, in one place, and you had those opportunities to build those relationships over a very, very long period of time?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think it was an advantage. You know, they're like, you know, we used to kind of laugh. In Chambers, there wasn't shopping malls. There wasn't all these other things to pull kids away. You know, what they did was the sports.
Yeah.
That was their shopping mall, was coming to the gym. So that was, I think that was an advantage, because I talked to a lot of coaches, and some coaches we played that lived in, you know, bigger urban areas. They're like, well, these kids got so much going on. Oh, we don't have that, you know, we don't have that going on. So
yeah,
that was probably a little bit of an advantage for us.
What else about your player development? What did you put together with your program there that helped out a lot with that?
Well, I think, you know, just getting kids in there, learning. I always want to play at a fast pace, and I always want to play with an intensity of defense. So we really stress in our practice schedules, no matter what age group, we're going to be moving all the time. We don't like long lines. We don't want kids standing around. You get, especially younger kids, you get them standing around, you start getting that goofing around in the back of the line and wrestling with each other. And I see that a lot of times when I'll go watch some stuff. But so, you know, we really tried to keep them busy. We try to make it fast paced. We, you know, again, we kind of try to make it fun with some type of a competition type thing. And that's kind of the way we run our high school practices. We, about every 3 minutes, we're into something else. It's quick. We don't take, like, long water breaks. I know a lot of people nowadays don't like that. They think they need to clear their heads a little between breaks. But we transition from one to the next. It goes quick. It's organized. I think kids have always want to know that things are organized and disciplined, and they'll thrive on. They may not want to be disciplined, but I think they thrive on it when things are organized and disciplined. And we labor hours over our practice schedules.
Yeah.
When the next one gets done, you're making the corrections. Well, you've got to go back and you might have the whole week done. So then that changes your whole next day. And you just don't want to leave any stone unturned as far as that goes. So, mm-hmm. You know, And I love that part. I love the practice schedule. I love sitting down and working on them and looking at things. You know, to me, that's half the fun of coaching and running practices. So,
yeah, that is going to be the part that I was actually talking about that with my wife. You know, just, I'm going to miss putting together a practice plan. I'm going to miss, you know, just all of that type of stuff. Those are the things that I will miss, you know, and I feel like that's the reason why we all get into it. Right. I mean, is for those things. And so, yeah, I hear you right there, John. That's definitely 1,000% what I'm going to miss the most. So, let's talk a little pressure defense. Let's talk about implementing pressure defense, John. What did you do? How did you implement it? Maybe some drills that you ran. What was the reason behind your philosophy? I just asked you about six questions there, so I'll just let you go there. I'll just let you go there on pressure defense. Tell us about it.
Well, it's kind of funny because when I first started with the girls, teams didn't press. The only time you pressed is if you were behind late in a game. Uh-huh. In the last couple minutes. It was almost like there was actually, I think there were some coaches that thought it was illegal to press until the last 2 minutes. And so when I first started with it then, I mean, that's what we started with. Full court, you know, no dribble stuff, zigzag things, just playing pressure defense, pressure defense, pressure defense. And it was crazy because we were one of the very few teams that in our area and in our conference that actually did press.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I think a lot of people kind of started to emulate it and start doing it a lot more that way. We press actually on made and missed baskets. And it just seems like you get turnovers that you would never, ever get. I mean, you'll get a travel, you'll get somebody chuck it out of bounds. It would have never happened if you wouldn't be pressuring them. You know, the key is you can always say, well, we don't want to be giving up layups at the other end. Well, we kind of keep an analytical thing, and we work pretty hard on not giving up layups at the other end. And we work hard on a number advantage things with 3-on-2, 4-on-3, 5-on-4 type of things to get our kids to really believe that we can fly around and four of us can stop five. And so we kind of build that mentality of things. And then we always, you know, sell to our kids, man, in the fourth quarter, you know, we if you can say it on here, but we use the term, we want 32 minutes of hell.
Yep.
And we want them to mentally break. And I've seen that in so many games where we were in tight games till the last 3-4 minutes. And man, we would break it open and win by 15, 16, basically because we just wear out the other team.
Mm-hmm.
Now when I switched to boys, everybody told me you can't do that.
Yeah.
You can't press boys. Well, we still press. The last year I was at Chambers, we ended up like 18-5, and we beat a 19-0 team in the conference championship. And our boys had kind of struggled too up until that point. So when I went to Southern Valley, that's all I heard. What, you're not going to press, are you? You can't press. And, you know, we pressed and worked hard in practice and developed that intensity. I always said I'd rather have to call them off than try to get them to get up there and play defense. And so again, that's an edge I think we can go into every game with. And then the other important thing was, and we preach this to our team too, you know what? You know how much time this team is spending on their press break?
Absolutely.
And handling. We have just robbed them of what they actually want to do by them having to get ready for us, knowing that we're going to press them. So, you know, that's kind of a little bit of our philosophy of pressure defense. And, you know, we get so many, a lot of easy baskets. We, you know, our kids, we kind of joke, we don't want to run an offense.
Yep.
We want to steal it and go out and make a layup or get a 2-on-1 or 3-on-2. And we don't want the heck with running an offense. So,
yeah. What are some of the pressures that you like to run, John? And how did you, why, I guess?
Well, the biggest one is I was always a Rick Pitino fan when he was at Louisville.
Oh, yeah.
And he was a 2-2-1 guy. Bob Schnitzler at Battle Creek had a lot of success in the late 80s girls, and they actually were 2-2-1 pressing then. I think I've diamond pressed and 2-2-1. Actually, our diamond is our 2-2-1. We just tandem our back row, bring one of them up on the ball and one of them to half court. And we have some different things we want to do depending on what you're going to try to do. And that's the fun part of the scouting is, you know, how is this team going to break your press? Who's their ball handler? Who can we take away? And that strategy is fun to develop as we go. But the 2-2-1 and our shell in our 2-2-1 is completely positionless. So we could end up with our two forwards in the front, our two guards in the back, just depending on offense, how we transition. And then, of course, we try to keep our big guy back. But we do a lot of those drills in practice, which is fun because the kids get to get out on the floor and we get into our press. But those are my two main things. And then we do a little bit of man-to-man run and jump, just to kind of maybe out of a timeout, one possession type deals, just to throw a wrinkle in and make you prepare.
Mm-hmm. Coaches, by now you have seen the newest thing coming out of a pen and a napkin, the opening tip, Substack newsletter. I put an edition out there for free, and hopefully you see what a great investment this is going to be for you as a coach. I'm guessing it probably is, if you watch everything and listen to everything, it's going to take you almost 3 hours to get through everything on the opening tip newsletter here. What do we have in there? You've got an original article by myself here. Just thoughts, ideas on different coaching topics. Into the Lab. That's probably my favorite thing is the Into the Lab. It's me, another coach, and a whiteboard, and we're just drawing stuff up here. Stuff to help you out, to help you become better, and to help your team become better this coming season and beyond. got another exclusive podcast. You heard the first one, Industriousness from the Wooden Pyramid of Success. And it's me and it's two semi-retired former girls basketball coaches, Matt Kern of York, Nebraska, Nate Wall of David City Aquinas here in Nebraska. And every newsletter, we're going to break down an aspect of Wooden's Pyramid of Success. Bookshelf recommendations from off the bookshelf, X's and O's stuff. I'm dropping in a university video. It's just going to be given to you there. You know, and I really believe in the products that I've put together. It's practical stuff that's going to help make you a better coach. And then we've got the Coach's Corner with links to clips and articles. As you saw, we had our two Olympic coaches, Steve Kerr and Cheryl Reeve. Just really, really good stuff here. And I know it's subscription-based, but goodness gracious sakes alive, as Coach Wooden would say, it is so affordable. $8 a month for two newsletters. That's $4 every newsletter. That's $2 every single week. Or you can get a year-long subscription, $75. That's 24 editions of the newsletter. That's basically $3 a newsletter. That's basically a dollar an hour if it takes you about 3 hours to get through everything that you're getting here. It could not be more affordable. It could not be more positive for you. It's going to help make you a better coach. So subscribe to the Opening Tip newsletter. Folks, you're not going to regret it. Well, with that, of course, like you just said, and I'm right there with you. I don't want to call a bunch of offenses, a bunch of set plays, or anything like that either. We want to get up and down. We want to fly up and down, and part of that is implementing a transition offensive mentality and philosophy as well. So, how did you team these two things together, John? Your pressure defense with your transition offense.
Well, the thing is. We want to try to keep as much as we can positionless. I mean, I know that's kind of a word that's probably maybe a little bit overused, but, you know, if we get a steal, we just got certain areas on the floor that we want filled, that we want a rim runner, you know, and kids just kind of learn to fill those spots. And, you know, if they can get an easy basket out of it, they're going to run hard. And so, you know, the thing of it is, you get to play a lot of players that way too, because for 32 minutes to run and press for five guys is about impossible. But you get to play some more people that way. But you know, we can spend a lot of time in our practices now. Our we could just call it our pressure log, where we're really working on both. One team's always having to work on the press while one's transitioning and breaking it, and, you know, back and forth. So we're getting a lot done with our kids, and we're getting a lot of up and down. We might take a few minute break then and shoot some free throws or a quick shooting drill, and boom, we're right back after it again. A lot of kids aren't standing around. We're really going. So it's just kind of it's fun. And it's, for me, coaching wise, it's fun to sit and watch them. We're going up and down the floor. There's hardly any talking ever from coaches or kids not doing anything. So our 2 hours of practice, I think we get an awful lot done during that time.
Mm-hmm. Are you with like your transition stuff? Are you doing some things like, Loyola Marymount, you know, two runs this side, three runs this way, or, you know, you said you wanted to be as positionless as possible, but do you still have some things in there that, hey, Billy, we need you to rim run every time, or, you know, things like that?
Well, I got, the thing is that we've kind of worked hard, especially at Stewart over the last 7 years, but almost every kid can handle the basketball.
Uh-huh.
So what we call it peel and go. If you rebound it, you're going.
Uh-huh.
But we really don't waste a lot of time on getting an outlet, unless it's a kid that is just between him and I are saying, you know what, I really don't want you bringing the ball down, and I don't think you're comfortable with it. So let's try to get it to, you know, this particular kid, and we might tell our point where, you know, so-and-so, I want you coming back for it. But otherwise, yeah, we have two kids. Usually we designate one of you is either a trailer or one of you's got a, we want a foot race to the other end. If you're ahead of him, you're the rim runner. And then we've got three wings or two wings and a point, whatever, get to the corners. And so It's not really real structured, I would say. We just want areas to fill. And if two of you fill the area, you run down and somebody's already in that area, just cut through.
Yeah.
You know, cut through, get to the other side, balance things out. And our key to that is how we want to sell our kids is I don't want the defense to in any way, sense or form, take a breath, relax and figure out what they're in or who they got. We want to be on top of them so fast and going without ever, you know, without them having any chance of organization defensively. We want heads spinning for them.
So piece this all together for us here, Coach. You know, take us through pressure defense, transition offense, and all the other things that you got to do. What does a typical, what's a typical John Miller practice look like?
Typical practice. Well, we do. We always start off with some ball handling things. And what I mean by ball, I mean, we're doing the escape dribble stuff. We're doing the two slow, one quick, back fast again. We're working up and down the court. I'd probably say for about 5 minutes. We go 5 minutes into a hard passing drill up and down the floor. I like to run a lot of 5-on-0 passing with two teams at both ends of the floor. We go up and down 4 times, and then the other team's right into it, and we're working on our transition. We're working on our press break. We've got options. We've got other passers underneath that everybody's getting shots up. So we kind of go into there. Then we kind of break into some shooting drills, game-like stuff, you know, work on our Euros, reverse pivots, post stuff, are banging on each other. I've got a great assistant coach that takes those guys. We're working on the stampede dribble with the kick to one side shots, the baseline dribbles to the dunker in the middle. Everything's going full speed. We're working it at every basket. And then we go into our defensive drills. I'd say we, you know, work on our footwork. We got all kinds of stuff. There's shell drills. There's our presses, our trap drills. Probably got 20 of those types of things. We just alternate them, plug them in. Then we work a little bit on our, maybe 7-10 minutes on an offensive side of things where we, if we want to put in a new inbounds or maybe we're not running a last set right at the end of a shot clock type thing, you know, we'll review those kind of things, with dummy defense or with a 5-on-0 thing where they go back and forth. And then we usually, right in the middle of practice, put all of our fast break drill stuff in. We have 2-on-2, 3-on-3, 4-on-4, get back stuff the kids really like. Put a lot of 2-on-1, 3-on-2, 4-on-3, 5-on-4, 5-on-5. We'll play to a certain number and then reset it. So, you know, we do a lot of numbers advantage things during that time. And then we play a lot of 5-on-5-on-5 with pressure defense. Okay, we're working on a diamond this time, up and back. We do a lot of stop, score, stop stuff during that situation.
Love it.
And then the other team comes on, and then we finish with some special situations. We try to do something. And then we throw in those pressure drills with the five. We do that too. Like this time we might tell, okay, we're taking it off at, taking it out at half. We're taking it out at three quarter or quarter court and then into it. So we're not just starting with the ball at the top of the key and running it and going. Or maybe it might be an inbounds of where we start each time. So we've got a lot of mixture. We probably do that now 15, 20 minutes. And then the special situational stuff, we'll look at, and then I usually leave about 35 minutes. 30 is about what it takes at the end, just to clean up, you know, some things that I might want to do, or I want to spend more time on that we haven't got to. And then we always try to end with some kind of a fun drill, some kind of a shooting drill. We do free throw brackets, free throw challenges. I keep a record and post, you know, a record league, you have little teams and win loss records. And then we do a tournament bracket with it. We do it with 3-point shooting. You know, we kind of try to melt down that way. And then we finish with some postural work, just for your hips and legs, knees kind of stuff. And while they're doing that on the floor, I'm kind of reviewing practice and asking them. I try not to talk. I try to make them tell me what they thought, what they did well, what they want to make sure that they want me to put in the practice schedule the next day. Those kind of things. So I kind of rambled on.
No, that's great. No, I love it. That's why we do this. That's why we do this, is to talk about things like that. So, how much has your practice planning changed over the years? I mean, you got a lot of scrimmaging, a lot of up and down, but if you're going to play transition basketball, if you're going to pressure, you've got to sacrifice. I mean, you can't be great at everything. You got to pick out your three or four things that you hope to be great at by the end of the year and really, really emphasize those things. And that's the sacrifice you're willing to make there, it sounds like, John.
Well, and we're going to preach to our kids too, that, what our identity is.
Yeah.
I'll tell them, we're going to make no bones about it. When we get off the bus and walk in your gym, you're going to know exactly who we are and what we're going to do to you. And so they understand that if that's going to be our identity, we better work on it. I'm not going to be a power running football team and never work on blocking or being physical up front, So, we spend a lot of time on it. And again, like I said earlier, we're going to sell the idea that we're going to be in better shape. It's just going to be tough for them to stay that kind of, intensity for 32 minutes like we are going to do. So,
yep.
And then we go 2 hours early, probably about middle of the year. We go back to an hour and a half, and probably the last three and a half weeks, I probably cut it down to an hour. Mm-hmm. Each one, and kind of specify exactly what we need to work with. So,
mm-hmm. John, great stuff here tonight. If folks would want to reach out to you and ask you a few more questions here, how would they be able to get a hold of you?
I'm fine with my phone number, 402-340-9215. My email is millerj811@gmail.com. I love doing this. I've had an opportunity to speak at the coaches clinic a couple different times. In Lincoln, I spoke at the Albuquerque clinic a couple years ago. A lot of those coaches reached out, had a lot of fun sending them stuff, talking to them on the phone. Even during their season, they would call up with questions. And I got help along the way from some fantastic people. And I think that the neatest thing about this in profession, even more so than the wins and losses and the kids, is just being there for each other and helping each other. And to me, that's really important. So,
yeah, well, that's what we're trying to do here through a pen and a napkin. And Coach, I really appreciate your time tonight. I hope your time was enjoyable here on the podcast.
I could sit and talk basketball for a long time, and I apologize if I kind of ramble a little bit. So you got so many things, and your mind kind of races, and sometimes it probably might not come out that clear. But I hope you can make sense of it.
No, I did. My mind races a little bit slower than everybody else. I'm kind of more at that Michael Scott speed, a mile a minute, type of a deal. Or a mile an hour. I can't remember what he said in that scene there. So sorry, Michael, Gary Scott. I didn't mean to offend you there. So great stuff here tonight, John. Thank you so much for your time. If you can hold the line here just a second, going to wrap up a couple of things here. Again, John Miller, legendary coach here in the state of Nebraska. Tremendous job. Still coaching here today. Hall of Famer. So many great things that he's done in the game and for the game here in the state. I want to thank him for his time. We want to thank Cosac Chiropractic for all that they've done for the pod. Thanks for following us on Twitter. Again, I'm trying to get this figured out. It's really, really frustrating. I made one little mistake on some little thing, and they're locking me out like some Russian hacker here or something. I don't know what's going on, but I'm going to get it figured out. I'm going to get it figured out here. Download, rate, and review this. Any questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me at penandanapkin@gmail.com. It's been awesome having John Miller on the podcast here tonight. I encourage coaches to take him up on his offer, give him a holler, and let him know that, you know, just if you have any questions, just ask. He's a fountain of information. So, coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.